and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, listeners. And today's guest joining me all the way from the South Coast is George Galbraith, Managing Director of Jam Cycling. So George is going to tell us a little bit about some of the products that they import and distribute throughout the cycling world. But I primarily know George as the man who introduced me to InfoCranks by Verb Cycling. So anyway, firstly, George, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're looking, I can see George, what you can't see, listeners, is I can see George on the video screen. He looks every bit like a mountain man. He's got a big bushy beard, straggly hair. He's in the warehouse with lots of bits and pieces of cycling equipment being carried up and down and ready to be sent out. So if you hear any strange noises going on in the background, it's not the mice.
Yeah, big old mice around here.
Yeah, so George, tell us a little bit about how you got into distributing these products. Tell us about the products you distribute and then maybe go in a little bit deeper on InfoCrank, because that's how I first, sure, you and I first met.
Exactly, yes. So I got into the cycling world, but I suppose I cycled into the cycling world probably about 6 years ago. I took a sabbatical and I rode from London to the middle of Italy. I was heading to a family holiday and instead of flying, I decided to take my bike. Had time on my side, so I just kind of went on a journey. Along the way, I stayed with a friend of mine from university. Her dad, he lives out in Italy, and she said, "You know, is a bed for the night. He loves cycling like you. He's an engineer. Go and meet him, and he'll put you up for the night, give you a beer." So I did, and turns out he was the engineer on a product, which was a project at the time. It wasn't a fully made product. He was an engineer on a product to make power meters for the Australian Institute of Sports. So the Australian Olympic Institute had commissioned him and a group of engineers to design a very specific type of power meter. And I stayed there and we got chatting and I stayed for a few days. And essentially, they brought me on to help turn the project into a consumer-facing product. I basically helped implement the global distribution plan and how we're marketing the product and a whole variety of things. I managed the relationship with British Cycling they had for a long time. They sponsor the British Triathlon relationship. They sponsor a lot of the other high-level athletes. I effectively cycled myself into the cycling world. Very fortunate, right place, right time. And I had the right skill set that they kind of needed. I did that for 3 years, working directly for those guys. And then I took on the mantle of being the lead distributor for the product here in the UK. I wanted to spend a little bit less time traveling. I wanted to spend a bit more time focusing on the UK market. And that allowed me to also build a portfolio of other similar products, complementary products to the power meter. So I could effectively offer a wider range of things to the stores I was working with, the athletes I was working with. So now I have the distribution for the InfoCrank, and we do various other racing kind of products as well under the title of my company, which is called Jam Cycling. So yeah, so there was Verve, those guys are the engineers, they make the InfoCrank, and then there's Jam, which is, I suppose, me nowadays.
When I first met you, I think you mentioned British Cycling there. I know you already got this product being used by AIS. Mm. Camera, and you were about to go and pitch this product to British Cycling, who were heavily invested with SRM power cranks.
Oof, so, all they were.
if people know about SRM power cranks, it's all based in the chain set, isn't it? It's not bottom bracket, it's not in the pedal, it's not in the hub, it's all in the chain set. And they were the market leader. They were probably the first into the market, really, of power meters. They're the one that everybody knows. And they're also the really expensive. And British Cycling used them on all the bikes at the track. And you were taking this new product to them. And I remember you telling me, I remember you telling me about going to pitch for this. And I thought, whoa, good luck if you get that one. And you did.
Mm.
So what was it about your product that made British Cycling change from something they'd been using for years to something completely, I suppose for them it was untested, although you did have the evidence of what the Australians were doing.
Yeah, good question. So their relationship with SRM was, as you say, it was total. That they had specific employees employed in Manchester to maintain their whole fleet of SRMs. That's how many they had and how invested they were in that product. What got the InfoCrank, what got the foot in the door with that product was how it came into existence. We, the engineers, were not a product company to begin with. They weren't trying to build a product to sell to the open market. They were tasked with creating a specific something. There was a problem that the AIS highlighted initially with how most power meters work, and they tasked this group of engineers with fixing that problem. And because they approached it in that manner, they basically built a superior product. And the information, the data that came out of the testing with Australia and the work we did down there meant that when British Cycling inevitably got wind of it, they kind of couldn't ignore it, if you like. In terms of pitching for the business, we didn't really have to pitch. The product did the work for us. We had to deal a lot with taking care of the commercial aspect of such a small product, working with such a big and mighty successful beast as British Cycling, because their sponsor contracts run into the hundreds of thousands of millions of pounds. So that was a lot more of the where I was involved in that process at the beginning. But really, they kind of couldn't look past the InfoCrank once we built it. It did a lot of the things that the others at the time and still just weren't doing. To the extent that they ended up actually boxing up all their SRMs, putting them in a locked away in a corner. They bought them all. They weren't sponsored for it. They put them all in a box and they bought in, and their first order was for 100 cranks to kind of get them across all their athletes. And at the time, the reason I quite liked working with that group is that they weren't so much worried about their top end, the already performing gold winning athletes. They wanted to get the first 100 in, and they got them straight away onto all of their development squad, all the young guys and girls, the kind of 15 to 17 year olds that were coming through the ranks. They said, you know, this is our next focus, the next generation. We wanted this product for those guys because that's what's going to help us get them to the podium spots, to the gold medal spots.
Most of those development riders, were they riders that were going to be on the track, or was it a range of track, BMX, mountain bike, road?
Great question. It was, as with British Cycling, most things were track dominated, but we ended up putting them on BMX riders and putting on mountain bike riders. We even looked at trying to make specific units for those different disciplines, and we have helped where we can. But as with a lot of things that British Cycling do, you know, it was centered on their track program, and then, you know, athletes then go and specialize in other areas. A lot of their track riders would go and do a bit of road racing. So everybody in the BC program, as well as their specialist bike for whatever discipline they did, they would always have a road training bike. And that's the key thing that BC wanted the data from very early on, was all of that reliable, comparable data straight away from all their athletes. And that essentially brings us back to the question of what the Australian Institute of Sport were looking to solve, that the reason they asked for this product to be created was because they had a range of athletes all using different products. Because, you know, they, at the time, you know, if there's, I don't know how many states there are in New Zealand, 7 or 8, something like that. But each area, each cycling area had their different products they're associated with. So they might have 50 athletes that have stages, they might have 30 that have an SRM, they might have some that have nothing, some that have a power tap. And the problem the central governing body had essentially is a lot of that data, they couldn't compare one athlete from the West's power files with one athlete from the East's power files, because they were using two different products that worked in slightly different ways. And they basically tasked us to bridge that gap so that all the data points could be comparable.
Well, that's an interesting point, actually, George, there, because somebody, I took the liberty of asking some of my Facebook followers if they had any questions for you. And one of the questions centres on exactly that particular topic, which is, if a watt is a standard measurement of power, why is there such a difference in watts depending on which brand or type you use? So let's, before we go into that, let's identify the different types of ways in which you can measure power that are widely available. So I'll tell you the ones I know, and then you can add more or correct me if I'm wrong. So you've got yours and the SRM that we've talked about, which are based in the actual chain set, generally a little disc in the middle. You've got some that are based in the bottom bracket. Mm-hmm. You've got some that have the power measurement in the, in the crank area. You've got the pedals that are detachable and removable and movable within different bikes. And then you've got the power tap type of system, which is based in the hub of the rear wheel. So have I missed any of that list?
I don't think so. So if the way I think about it is from the rider down, you've got what comes first. So pedals, you get pedal systems. Next comes the crank, you get crank systems, which is what ours is. Then you've got the spider, which is the kind of arms that the chainring's attached to, which is where the SRM is. Okay. There has been a brand that did them in the chainrings themselves. Then you get the spindle of the cranks, and that's where you get the next version. And then further back down the chain, you can kind of go into the hub, as you said, so you can get them into the rear hub in the wheel.
Okay, so if they're all measuring a unit of power, why is there so much variance then? And because there seems to be so much variance, how do potential customers? I mean, clearly the AIS didn't know which one to choose, so they wanted similarity across the brand. But how do customers know which one to trust and what they should be going for?
So
when they're spending their money.
Yeah, so it's a great question. I'll try and answer it as succinctly as possible. It's a fairly complex question. So let's address the first point. What are they all measuring? To produce a watt, a unit of power, is an equation. That equation involves taking a reading of torque. So what the power meter's essential job is to do is to measure how much force is being created, how much torque is being created in a certain part of the bike. That stress, that torque, is basically multiplied by the cadence. And then in the case of a crank-based system or a pedal-based system, is then multiplied by the lever involved, so the length of the crank arm. So the simplest answer as to why there's difference between the different brands is it usually comes down to how well the brands can do the two or three parts of that equation. So the first part being how well can they measure the stress. So that's how good of a raw instrument are they. The second part, then how well can they measure the cadence and apply that and times it by the stress? And then how well do they know the length of the lever? Most brands usually let themselves down on their ability to read cadence accurately. And that's where we can quite quickly see how what numbers can differ between products. Because if you're producing a certain torque value, if you times it by the wrong number, so if you don't count cadence accurately, and instead, if you've maybe done 90 revolutions in that minute as opposed to 100 revolutions in that minute, there would be a very big difference between the outcome of what that watt number looks like. So the simple answer to the question, why are they quite different, is because they normally do something in that process not quite as well as they should. And it normally comes down to how well they can read cadence. Cadence is a tricky thing to count.
So bearing that in mind then, how does a system like the power tap that's based in the hub, I can see how things that are based on the end of the crank arm or within the crank or around the bottom bracket can measure cadence, because that's happening right there and they're right in the center or on the edge of it. But how does something that's removed by a couple of feet at the back of the bike measure cadence then? Is it based on an algorithm and some sort of assumption?
So if I remember correctly, I think it uses an accelerometer, but the accelerometer takes the role of a cadence magnet. Most people, regardless of how new they are riding a bicycle, will have a reasonable idea what a cadence magnet looks like, even if you've got a very 12-pound cat-eyed system, usually comes with a cadence counter, onto the front wheel to give you a certain measure of speed, right, and distance. You can substitute that, and a lot of brands substitute that cadence magnet, because magnets are deemed to be unsightly and less aerodynamic. You can substitute that out for an accelerometer. Accelerometer is the same technology that's in your smartphone. When you turn your smartphone sideways, it alters the picture and turns it to help you view the way that the phone is orientated. The problem comes with its applications are quite well suited to smartphones and things, but in the dynamic system that you get inside of a bike where things are rotating very, very fast, they have a bit of a latency in there. So they're not quite as good at counting exact cadence as a magnet would be. Now, almost no brands use magnets anymore. They use basically the accelerometer and then they apply it with an algorithm. But the rear hub, I'm pretty sure, uses an early version of the accelerometer.
Okay, right. So that's interesting. And so that answers the question that people have about why there are slight variations. Now, somebody else asked me a question here. He said, I see a very big difference between my power indoors and outdoors and between my TT and my road bike. We're talking about 20 to 30 watts here. So let's say your average age grouper has a power output of, you know, an FTP of somewhere between 200 and 300. We're talking about around 10% variance there between the various things. So if somebody's riding indoors versus outdoors, because there's two questions there. Indoors versus outdoors, I assume that we're talking about he's using the same bike indoors, but he's one's riding on a smart trainer, the other one is riding out on the road. So would that naturally cause a variance, and why would that be?
It would naturally cause a variance. And the key thing in there is momentum. So when you're isolated indoors on the bike, let's take out the how good your power meter is. Let's assume your power meter is working and doing its job well. When you're on the road, momentum that's building up with every pedal stroke means that you're having to apply force in a smaller arc for every pedal stroke. So if you imagine the face of a clock, if you're rolling along at 20 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour, to complete a pedal, to make an effective pedal stroke, you might only be having to apply force between 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock on the clock face, because the momentum is helping the whole thing move along. Indoors, where you typically have a rear wheel that is hindered by something, so it's got a magnet slowing it down or it's got a resistance on it, you're having to work that bit harder for every pedal stroke. So the problem that basically means and relates to how things are working is that it's two different ways of riding a bike. So you could expect there to be a difference between your indoor power and your outdoor power. 20 to 30 watts is usually quite reasonable. And the difference in terms of whether it's higher or lower kind of depends a little bit on the system you're using for your indoor training.
That was my question. Is it likely then that your power indoors is overestimating your ability, and if that was the case, you'd take that into your racing outdoors and be trying to push too big a wattage, which may not be a problem for a cyclist, but for a triathlete, who are most of my listeners then and readers, then that's going to have an impact on their running.
I mean, that's definitely the case. And again, as I said, when you're outside, the inertia helps, which actually means that you can apply more force into the drive part of the pedal stroke, as opposed to having to use it in the second half of the pedal stroke, the pickup phase, to keep your momentum. So your power numbers typically are higher outside, and your power is being used in the right way. Inside, you're typically losing power to keep the momentum higher. So whenever I look at indoor training, you're normally training to a slightly lower version of your outdoor race pace. Now, the interesting factor comes if you do your FTP test inside, how does that relate to what your racing number should be outside with momentum? That's an interesting factor that has to change depending on how you've done your FTP test.
Yeah, okay. Well, we've got a question on that actually coming up about terrain and FTP test. But let's cover off this final question is, why is there a difference between somebody, let's say somebody's outdoors now, they're riding their road bike, but when they get on the TT bike, the power is different, again, by 20 to 30 watts. My assumption of that is that most people aren't bar the top time trialists, most people aren't efficient in their aero position at producing power. So they just don't work enough at their FTP in the aero position. And that's why when they get on the TT bike in that sort of aero position, it's not the same as sitting up with your hands on the hoods.
It's exactly that. So it's all in the positional difference. I'm a road racer and I do quite a lot of time trialing. I know, even though I spend a good amount of time on my time trial bike, I know my time trial numbers are consistently 15 to 20 watts down on where I am on my road bike. And that's all about the position my body's in and therefore the ability of my body to be able to exert the same amount of force it would do if I'm ever slightly more upright, you know, in terms of where my hip tilt is, etc. Most people's TT bikes are set up ever slightly more aggressively. So it's just purely down to positional change. And I think even in some of the top level time trialists, they have a very clear different number from their TT bike to on their road bike.
Of course, if you're on a TT bike, you get the aero advantage. So you could actually go faster with less power output because you're more aerodynamic. I mean,
entirely.
What did Bradley Wiggins push out for his hour time trial record? Somewhere around 440 watts?
I think that was
I guess he could have sat up on his road bike and pushed out 450, but his overall distance covered in the hour would have been less.
Yes, exactly that. Exactly that. So by getting lower, you are gaining more speed. It's harder for your body to produce that speed, but you don't. Your watt number isn't quite as high. It kind of doesn't have to be. But also, you are hindered because of the position you're putting yourself in.
So there's got to be some element of rider familiarity with position then. And so if you want to get closer to your ultimate wattage, you've actually got to spend time at that effort level in the aero position in order to be comfortable with it. And I mean, it is possible because the top riders are able to get closer to their ultimate, you know, there's less of a variance.
And I think if you were to look at the big difference of what do those top riders do that the average, the amateur athlete can't do, it's getting that quality time in that position outside at race pace, because again, they can pick and choose and they can be in warm weather camps for a lot longer. And you know, they can, most of them go and live in different parts of the world for different parts of the season. And it's exactly that. It's how much time can you get on the bike outside replicating what you're going to be doing on race day.
Great. That's a good answer. Thank you, George. Now I did mention there that somebody had asked about you mentioned FTP tests indoors versus outdoors. And another question we've got was, do you factor in the terrain when performing an FTP test? What adjustments need to be made, if any, for different terrain if you have an FTP? So firstly, let's go back to covering FTP tests. Stephen Seiler, who's done a lot of research, he's a very credible sports scientist and physiologist based in Norway, an American guy. He actually said at a conference, "I don't believe in this 20-minute FTP test. FTP is supposed to give you a pretty accurate estimate of what you can hold for an hour. So if you're going to do a test for an hour."
Yeah.
And I just, let me finish here. I could see all the triathletes in the room, sort of their heads dropping, thinking that they'd now got to triple their power and their pain threshold to get that test in. Equally, on the opposite end, their trainer Road have tried to introduce a shorter test this year because clearly they know that most people don't look forward to doing a 20-minute test, let alone a 60-minute test. So if you can tell them they can get an accurate assessment in 4 minutes, a lot of people are going to jump on that.
Yeah, and in a way, the coach you're referencing there, he is completely right. If you want to get the most honest reference of where you're at, the way I always think about it is you've got to go and do a 25 mile time trial. You've got to do an hour, as close to an hour effort as possible, because that's essentially what we're trying to, what the question of FTP, what it's trying to answer is, how hard can you work for the hour? Now, of course, you can, there's enough data out there nowadays, there are enough people riding bikes with power that clever programs such as the WKO4 and Trainer Road and Zwift and all these guys, they can build models that can essentially offer you the ability to test for a much shorter period of time. And that will basically show where you would land on a curve for someone like you. And that would basically give a good estimate of what your hour would be. But there is no substitute for doing an hour effort. The problem, as you quite rightly say, with hour efforts is they are even 20-minute efforts, they're exceptionally hard to motivate an athlete to do well, get the right consistent terrain to do it on. And if you get it wrong, it's quite a long time before you want to put an athlete through that again. So, yeah, an hour would be the best, but it's not always feasible and psychologically difficult.
I think the thing from Sela's perspective as well, and I have some sympathy with this, is that let's say you do a 20-minute test and you get 200, you get 300 watts mm-hmm. in that 20-minute test, and then there's a sum, there's an equation you can put in, you multiply about that 300 by 0.95, so you take off 5%, so you lose 15 watts, and 285 is your estimated FTP. So now everybody then that uses this test is now basing their training and perhaps their racing based on this 285. You go and do a 1 hour test, and possibly because there's a mental aspect as well to pushing yourself and hanging on, you've got nobody to chase like you have in an outdoor time trial. They might get 275 watts, which is lower. And of course, everybody always wants to choose the higher time. They always take the best or the best, you know, the best number that they can. But, and this is where I have sympathy for the argument as a coach as well, is if you've got a high training load, particularly as a triathlon coach where you've got people swimming and running as well, is if they're constantly riding 2 or 3% too hard based on a slight overestimation of the power, that additional stimulus eventually builds up and can lead to athletes overreaching too soon. So I do get that. I have sympathy with both perspectives, because I've done 20-minute tests, and I tell you what, I do not want to ride for another 40 minutes.
Yes, yeah. 20-minute tests are hard work. You know, it's not something you'd want to be doing. If you looked at your training plan and saw that in your diary every week, your athletes very quickly would have a bit of pushback and a bit fed up with that, and in fact probably not want to ride their bikes at all. It's a great way to demotivate anybody. But that said, that's why I quite like race files, I suppose, because it's not always possible for everyone to achieve a great test. There's lots of things that can go wrong. You know, we've been talking about the accuracy problems with power meters for one, indoors versus outdoors, terrain, as the question was brought up. You know, how do you find somewhere outdoors that you can do a full 20 minutes at full gas without the terrain changing underneath you? For me, I love to then look at what the real imprint, the real useful data is coming from a race file. You know, how much in that actual environment, how many race, not so much tests, but how many kind of like pre-races you might do, how many kind of race type efforts, simulations, I suppose, sorry, is the word you're looking for, a word I'm looking for. That's where I like to get the bulk of the data that I work with and talk to people about.
Yeah, and I think that's where something like WKO comes in, because it'll take your best 5 minute effort, your best 20 minute effort, your best 60 second effort, your best hour effort from training sessions that you've done. And it will, if you're saving all the data, it'll be constantly tweaking those in the same way that Training Peaks sends you or Strava sends you a kudos that you've got a new best for 60 seconds and it can put those data points into a curve. And then, as you said, there's a pretty good estimate of what your FTP is, your VO2 max power is.
Exactly. And I suppose that's not to say that these things that are offering, you know, a 4 minute or an 8 minute or a 12 minute FTP test are wrong by any means, because they're not. It's just that we have to understand who are they aimed at and what are they aimed at trying to achieve. And I look at it as a bit of a spectrum, as like an athlete journey, if you like. The brands are trying to make it simple and bite-sized and not as daunting, because there are lots of people that are new to the sport, new to endurance sports as a whole. And the concept of long, hard tests puts a lot of people off. So if you can make things easier and you can kind of get people in that phase of training and testing themselves in a smaller bite-sized way, that's a really useful stepping stone. It might well be that a few years down the line, when they're training to a slightly higher level, they're dedicating more time to it, something like a WKO4 package, which looks at every single bit of data. You know, for me as a road racer, I probably do 30 races over the course of a year, multiple terrain. I don't have to test in the middle of the year, because WKO4 in the background is always looking at, right, he's just achieved a 12-minute effort on that climb in a race. Cool. We're going to use that data and we're going to update where his modeled FTP is. But again, that information is completely overwhelming for a first-year novice just getting into it and just trying to get some of the basic race craft right and not trying to worry too much about exactly where they are with their FTP.
I think that I come back to that with another question a bit about whether it's worth the money then. But before then, let's just finish off this one about terrain then. I guess if I've just been in the Alps and there were some 2-hour climbs there, so you could ride for an hour quite hard.
Yeah.
So if you're riding uphill, again, does that give you a false impression of your power versus riding on the flat where there's no momentum or not as much momentum? So you could actually think, oh, I'm king of the mountains here because I've pushed out 300 watts. But in a time trial on the flat or on gently undulating, would you be able to replicate that 300 watts?
Yeah, it's a great question. I suppose that the answer ultimately is if you're working on a hill, if you've got a long climb and you can do a 20-minute or an hour effort on it, you are going to get the best possible chance of getting a really high FTP number because you've got that constant gradient to push against. Therefore, every single pedal stroke, you've got the chance to be exerting maximum effort and you're going to record a nice high number. It'll be significantly, if let's say you go and do that test and you get a 300 watt result. If you then go and try and replicate that a few weeks later on the flat, you're going to find it significantly harder because you're having to work at a much higher pace, which brings in a whole multitude of other things you've got to consider, not least, you know, pointing your bike in the right direction to make sure you're not going to go into the back of a tractor somewhere. So terrain does matter, and the main thing is because it makes it easier to do a hard effort going uphill. Of course, you don't want it to be too hard because if you work with too steep a terrain and it puts you way over your threshold into the red, well, you might actually damage your chances of performing a good test. At the end of the day, we're testing here. It's got rigorous protocol around it. We're trying to achieve something. So if the terrain isn't right and you've got something too steep or the terrain drops away momentarily on the climb and you've got to try and catch yourself up again, that can hinder the numbers you're working with. When it comes to long distance triathlon, I suppose what you guys are trying to work with, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Sam, but you want to get as closer to that ideal, to the accurate number as possible, because that does make such a difference how you actually pace yourself come race day. Is therefore doing an FTP test up the side of a mountain a bit of a fool's paradise? Maybe, but it gives you a good indicator of what you can do. But you have to bear in mind that if you're happy, I've got 300, you have to recognize that with a bit of pinch of salt. I think if I'm racing on a very flat course here out on, I don't know, Lanzarote or something, if it's very, very flat areas, you're not necessarily going to push out exactly what you can do in that test. It's a marker.
I think that the difficulty with riding outside is finding somewhere that's safe and quiet and sustainable for a minimum of 20 minutes. You know, there's a patch of the old A1 near us where you could ride up and down where there isn't a great deal of traffic and you probably could do it, but it's still gently undulating and you are still going to have environmental things affecting you. So, you know, at some points you're going to get a cross tail, at some points you're going to get a headwind. So it's really difficult to keep your power up when you're running out of gears with a tailwind and going downhill. Equally, it's not so bad when you're riding slightly uphill into a headwind because you can just keep going. But then there's always a chance that you can overdo it and go into the red, like you said. The safety aspect would always concern me as a coach is if you've got your head down and you've got the stars and the red mist, are you going to miss that car pulling out or turning in front of you?
I couldn't agree with you more. And it's been seen too many times, especially if people are trying to perform that in an aero position. I think safety has to be considered paramount. So finding the right place to do those kind of efforts is, and that's why I think a lot of people do it inside because you lose all those extra stimulus to worry about. A great example with me personally, I was out in Calpe at a warm weather camp in February. There's a hill there that I knew if I was working hard should take me around the 20 minutes. So towards the back end of the camp, I did my FTP test up there. I got to the top in 19:30. I didn't go any further than that. I stopped it. You know, I'm not going to worry too much more about that last 30 seconds because if I'd have pushed over the top and started to descend, I'm opening up a whole other area of risk I didn't want to go into. But also I'd got enough data out of that 19:30 that then working with a coach, taking my ego out of it, we can look at the number and appropriately tailor it to what's actually useful for me. So to, you know, appreciate that it's up the side of a hill and, you know, I had perfect conditions, etc., and then make sure that what I'm then working from my training zones are relevant.
Yeah, so I mean, immediately springing to mind here is if you go to Lanzarote, the I've lost the name of it now. It'll come back to me. If you go to Mallorca, you can lose the Look climb or the Soyer climb from the valley there. Both of those are over 20 minutes. The climb that I'm forgetting now, not Fire Mountain, but the other one towards the north that goes inland. It'll come back to me. But that's a 20-minute climb pretty much up up to the observatory from Marietta down at the bottom. So that's a good climb. There's not much wind coming in there, so you really are just you against the bike.
Yeah, and look, that's when I did my last FTP test, was on that climb back in that camp, which is February or March, whatever it was. Now, I knew full well, come my training efforts several weeks later and back in the UK, I'm going to really struggle to put out that exact same number because it was up that hill, at the end of camp. But I knew where my marker was, and it helped me kind of push forward and kind of help me set my training zones. And again, that's the value of having a coach to help you interpret this information and kind of make sense of it for you and what's right for you.
Well, Tabayesco is the climb I'm thinking of. I've ridden it so many times. And yeah, it was escaping. So, as with most things, as well as using power, is this compromise thing. It's sure, you're going to be riding outside most of the time for racing, but consider the safety aspect. Consider whether the road you're going to choose gives you actually the best chance of getting a decent FTP without getting a tailwind or having to go downhill for a couple of minutes and lose some of that power you've sort of collected.
And again, Simon, could I just add one slight little point onto that as well, that I always forget until the last minute. Measuring, pacing yourself for a 20-minute or an hour effort actually takes a fair bit of practice to get that right. So, there is room for a lot of these smaller tests, especially people that are newer to endurance sport. You know, these are kind of nice gateways to try to, if you've never done a 20-minute threshold effort before, you can mess up the whole test by just not knowing how to pace yourself.
I'd agree entirely with that. When we used to distribute the compu trainers, we provided a program to help people boost their FTP. And the first thing was to do the 20-minute test. Mm-hmm. And I would say that people showed a massive improvement in the first 2 or 3 weeks, primarily due to understanding of how to pace themselves.
Yeah.
Just like you get when you give people a 400-meter time trial in the pool or a 3K test or on the track, they set off too quickly. They set off at the pace that's comfortable, that rapidly becomes uncomfortable. You actually have to realize that in order to give your all out best, the first half of your test actually has to be in control. I remember Bradley Wiggins saying, on the hour test, the first 15 minutes feel fairly good because you've got to go at the same power that you're going to be doing in the last 15 minutes. And it's in that back half where you really have to concentrate and start pushing through the pain and keeping your legs going.
It's almost
where the action takes place, is it?
It's almost an art unto itself getting that right. Yeah. And that's where, as a time trial rider, I can appreciate that because I do time trials most weeks, shorter distances, 10s or 25s. And I know full well now, after doing that for several years, I'm just better at performing the test because I'm so used to pacing those kind of efforts.
Yeah. So certainly a few factors to be taken into account there. Common sense and mindfulness about where you do the test, a certain amount of realism built into the result.
Yes, and that's so important.
And definitely an element of education about how to actually pace things, which I think most athletes probably need to do more of, for certainly triathletes with their running and the swimming as well.
I'm sure it's something we'll touch base on, but I think that's the real key point for me is the athletes themselves. You can have all the tech and the numbers in the world, but having a good overview of you yourself as an athlete, what hurts, what doesn't hurt, those things I think are so important outside of power testing.
George, if the uneducated person, and so let's start at the very beginning now. You talked about the new cyclist or the new triathlete or somebody who's been in the sport a little while and has heard something about power meters but doesn't really know what they should be buying. So we've got that uneducated purchaser who understands that it's going to add a bit of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What are, for that person first, what are the basics they need to be thinking about when just buying a power meter, regardless of whether it's crank-based, pedal-based, hub-based? I think there's probably some things before that they need to be thinking about. So what would you say that they are?
The primary thing that I ask every rider that's talking about power meters, the first question I ask them is, what kind of riding, racing, training are you doing, and what are you looking to get out of what you're doing, right? Because it's very easy to wade into it and look at a price tag and think that the highest price tag is going to get you the best, therefore it's going to make you the best. But ultimately, if you are new into the sport, you're only training maybe 4 or 5 hours a week, you don't perhaps need it. There's a whole range of products out there which can help support you that you don't have to go and spend the earth on. So the key thing for me when you're looking at buying a product like this is, what are you hoping to get out of it? If you are a young aspiring athlete and you want to go on to competing at a national or international level, then obviously you're going to have very different aims versus an age grouper who might just be trying to get round your first Ironman. So for me, it comes down to what works for you. If you've got the time and you're setting aside time for the training and you've got budget to work with, you need to get the best you can get in terms of measurement devices. You want to be looking at how good a measuring tool it is, not where it is on the bike, not what it looks like. You want to go for the one that gives you the best measuring tool for your money. If, on the other hand, like I said, you're newer into things, you're only putting aside 4 or 5 hours a week to your sport, and it's a bit fresh for you, then in that case, you go for the one that doesn't stress you financially and gives you a good introduction to starting to train with power. Because people that have the time and the money getting into it first, it takes time to learn how to ride to power, how to get the most out of those things. And a lot of people go spend a lot of money on a power meter, use it for a couple of months, but then might move away from the sport for whatever reason. So for me, it's all about understanding what you hope to get out of it. On the lower end of the scale of the market, you can get some very, very cheap, I suppose some of the pedal systems, some of the kind of fit yourself systems nowadays are quite cheap. You can get very, very cheap stages that go into a 105 crank arm, for instance, that I see on sale every now and again for £300, that kind of area. Those are a great introduction tool. But also, you don't need to spend that kind of money. You know, most people, if you've got a smart trainer and a Zwift, you can get a good feel and overview for how to work with power from using one of those. You know, Strava gives a good estimate as to what your power number is. Once you've got a good understanding of how to ride to power, what power does, how to pace yourself to power, and you've worked with it for a little while, you're committing time to your training, and you've got a clear idea of what you want to get out of it. Like I said, the key thing for me is getting the best instrument that fits your budget. Which one is going to give you the most consistent results, time in, time out, so that you can be given the best chance to give your key effort on race day unhindered.
I suppose if I play devil's advocate here a bit, George, and developing on from your point about why do you really want one? I remember when heart rate monitors came out, you'd see and go, look, see, 150, that's good, isn't it? You know, and
yes.
I've seen 160 today or 170. So they were constantly just trying to get this heart rate as high as possible. Or, you see that? That's my resting heart rate there, 45. And without knowing what context any of those figures had.
Yes.
So if you're going to get a power meter and just sort of at the top of the steepest hill where you've had to keep pedaling to go around and you've managed to put out 2 pedal revolutions where you've hit 450 watts, that does not mean you're better than Bradley Wiggins, who held that for 1 hour. But it's just a measure of the power you had to put in to get over that. But even that has to be in context, because if you're a 19-stone rugby player, that's probably a bigger effort for you than somebody who's a 7-stone mountain goat from Colombia.
Yeah.
So there's this thing about context. And then when you think about, right, if you just understand your body and you know that if you're breathing easy, you're probably developing your endurance. If you're breathing really hard, you're at the top end of your aerobic capacity. If you understand that, for a lot of people, the accuracy that having a power meter gives you in terms of all of the other things that you could be doing as well? Like, could I get more sleep to benefit me more than getting a power meter? Could I eat better food? Could I lose a few kilos?
Yeah, sure.
To improve my performance before a power meter. So it's not the panacea that's going to suddenly turn you from an average athlete into a great athlete. It's going to add a little bit more precision. But I'd always be saying, if budget is a thing, make a list of all the things that you could do. I'm doing it out of a little bit of business here, I'm afraid, George. But
make
a list of all the things that you could do that cost you nothing first that are going to help you improve your performance. And when you've exhausted that list, then look at the marginal gains. And I know that having a power meter is a little bit more than a marginal gain, but still I think that somebody wants a power meter thinking they're going to become a better cyclist, but they don't actually recover properly, or they're only getting 4 hours sleep a night, or they're eating KFC for breakfast.
So I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. You know, it's so often I'll look at an athlete and they've got, you know, the sleep counter on their wrist, and they've got the heart rate monitor, they've got the power meter, they've got all the gizmos, they've got all the fast things. Yeah, there we go. The key thing that I think that almost all amateur athletes can do better is understand themselves better and rest more. And that's usually coupled with, if you're asking yourself the question, should I be going and training and riding now? Normally the answer is no, sit down. Sit down, have a rest, because you've probably done enough. Ego comes into things so much, and that's fueled by a lot of the marketing, etc. It's that marketing that makes it very difficult to decide which power meter to buy, by the way. But I think most importantly, it's knowing yourself and getting all that rest. You then look at the next steps. If you want to go down the realms of getting the tech involved, it's applying it. If you've got the tech, knowing your zones is so, so, so important. The athletes that I see that train the best and get the best results, they know their heart rate zones and their power zones inside and out, so that it's not just on their bike. They've taken the time to actually understand it. So when they're sat there on a training ride, either by themselves or in a group, the wind might be blowing in their face, they're looking down and seeing a number, they are able to make the decision of whether or not they need to be pushing a bit harder or sitting back. And that's ultimately what a power meter is there to do. It's to give you knowledge when you're riding the bike, and retrospectively, once you've ridden it, to kind of make decisions that are going to help make you stronger. Nothing's going to make you stronger than sleeping and recovering well. The power meter there is a backup tool to help feed that whole process.
I have a funny story to go along with that, actually, George. A few years ago, when we were in Hawaii, the CompuTrainer booth was right next door to the Cannondale booth, and Faris Al-Sultan was sponsored by Cannondale, and he had his bike there, and the mechanic was sort of just checking it over before race day. And I noticed that he got an SRM power meter, you know, head unit. Yeah. And so I was chatting to the mechanic and looking, and then I noticed when I looked more closely that this head unit was covered over with plaster. So you couldn't actually see any of the display. And I said, well, what's the point in him having that there? He said, well, they collect all the data for one thing, so that they can review it afterwards. Number two, he had a contract with SRM, and they wanted to do, they didn't do live feeds on race day then, but they did put the power files up on Training Peaks so people could see them afterwards. And three, actually, he doesn't want to be distracted by that while he's racing. And then, a couple of days later at the press conference, or maybe it was a year later at the press conference, Norman Stadler was the favourite, and Faris was sat there on the press conference, and somebody said, so what do you do about power output then, Faris, when if Norman goes off down the road like he did the last time he won? And he said, well, he said, I can't sit there and just hold 300 watts if he's going. It's a race. I've either got the legs to go with him,
yeah,
in which case I have to ignore my power meter, or I haven't got the legs, in which case having a power meter is no good. So
yes,
what it came back to at the end was that on race day, he was doing that race based on feel. Now, that feel would have been informed by all of the rides he'd done with his power meter and thinking, right, this is 300 watts, my breathing's comfortable, my legs feel good. This is 350 and I can feel the lactic acid building up and my breathing's getting a bit shorter. So he did 99% of his riding with a power meter. He learned what that was telling him about his body, so that on race day, he didn't need to rely on it to get him in the right place for a victory.
That's exactly it. If I, yeah, you know, I've got a road race on Sunday, 100 kilometres in Oxfordshire. I will probably glance at my power meter occasionally just to kind of take stock of whatever happens to be occurring at the time. Can I sustain what's going on, or do I need to back myself up a little bit? When the racing's on and there's a break up the road that I've got to get onto or something like that, the power meter at that time, the power meter matters not. That's not going to help me bridge the gap. But once I'm in that break and it's my turn stand on the front, I have a little glance down and go, right, how many matches am I willing to spend here, knowing I've still got another 60K of this racing to go? And that's where, again, it becomes that tool to help you make decisions. If you don't know how to implement those decisions or what your zones are and what effect they have on you from a fatigue point of view, then it can't help. So it's all about kind of equipping yourself with the knowledge to be able to get the most out of your body. But ultimately, you've got to turn the pedals yourself.
The question that started all that discussion was, if you train with power, should you race with it? So it sounds like, George, that we both agree there that you use power in training to tell you about your body. So you do not need to rely on the power meter on race day. It's there as a backup, mm-hmm. but you know. And you know, when I think when people talk about the tour and how the riders are all governed by power, and you can see Froome looking down at his power meter, but those guys do not get to that level without having 100% understanding of what their body's telling them and, you know, whether they can go with it or not. They know. They don't need a power meter to tell them whether they're going to stay with the pace or not.
If you took all the power meters away before the start of next year and said none of you can ride with a power meter, the results would look remarkably similar, because the reality is they're all, you know, they know what they're doing. Those guys know themselves so well. In bike racing, especially at that level, there's a lot more gamesmanship that's going on than we as amateur athletes can really kind of grasp. And that, you know, it's such a different kettle of fish, that type of road racing. But ultimately, they as athletes are so in tune with themselves, they could get on just as well without it.
Let's go back to our novice athlete then, who's interested in a power meter. So they've got a budget, and now they're faced with this decision of, based on the question we solved earlier, was should they buy pedals? Mm-hmm. Should they get a rear hub, an interchangeable wheel? Should they get a crank arm based system, a spider system, a bottom bracket system? I'm afraid you're going to have to take your InfoCrank hat off here, George, and put on unbiased technical representative hat. What, apart from what they want to use it for, and budget, I guess, what else is going to help them make the decision? And ultimately, which do you think is the best option? Or does that mean you have to be biased?
I'll try and give it in the most unbiased sense that I can. The way I think about it in its purest form is what's the job that it's trying to do? It's trying to measure something that's going on in your body. It's trying to measure how hard your legs are working. So my common sense hat usually says the closer you can get to the athlete, the closer you are to the body, the better, the more reliable, the more accurate the data is roughly going to be. The problem they always had with systems that are further away down in the hub is that although they know how much energy is lost between the front of the bike and the back of the bike, it just makes it that little bit harder. That rear hub is trying to measure a force that is generated in the rider's thigh and translated through the leg, through the ankle, the stability muscles, and then into the bicycle. If you could design from scratch with no limitations a power meter, you design a little tiny capsule and you jam it in the rider's leg because you want to know how much raw energy they're building up and then pushing out again. For me, knowing how the science works of how the energy then flows from the rider into the bike, I would be looking for the instrument that is as close to the rider and in the most secure material. Now, what I mean by that is that it's got the force flowing through it. And I don't mean Jedi. What I mean is in terms of the energy that the rider's pushing on the crank, that force has to flow through the power meter somewhere. If your power meter is encased in plastic and stuck onto the back of something, well, that's usually a pretty good idea that it's not going to have a clear path with the flow of energy. You want to be as close to the flow of energy as possible with as little material in the way. So in my opinion, from seeing the science, inside of the crank arm is the best place to be, with as little hindrance between the strain gauges and the actual crank arm itself. The problem I've always found with pedal-based systems, even though they are closer, a pedal is another axle that's effectively flexing in a different direction to the bicycle. And that piece of metal you have to base the pedal around, that spinning axle, they're usually too soft. They usually, over the course of several months, they soften, and you know, a pro level rider will change his pedals a couple of times a season because they kind of wear themselves out. That wearing out process for a consumer becomes very expensive. We spoke earlier on about price points on power meters. For me, the key last consideration is how long is it going to last for? There are too many on the market, and I include in this several of the pedal-based systems, that they'll work absolutely great for a couple of months. But after that, 2 or 3 months of being jumped up and down on, because the materials selected aren't strong enough, they start to soften and they start to be a bit more flexible. It's not noticeable. You couldn't look at it and point and say, look, it's soggy there. But on a material level where it's measuring force, that's what's happened. It's become a bit more rubberized, which makes the power meter's job exceptionally difficult. And that's where a lot of algorithms get wrapped in. So I look at, if someone's trying to buy a power meter, your application, what you're trying to achieve out of it, and then when you're spending money, which one's going to get you the best lifespan out of that product. The example of the ones that we work with, we aim that they should have 5 years worth of riding time out of them on the crank-based system, because the crank is a sturdy piece of kit. A pedal system, I've ridden pretty much every system there is. Not all of them, but pretty much every system. We've seen pedal systems that lose their calibration after about 2 months worth of use, and after that they're losing 20 to 30% of data points. Now, what that means, in essence, is that after a few months, the data it's reporting isn't helping you as much as you think it is, because it's not quite as good as it was a little while ago. So if you're in the middle of a training block and that kind of data starts to erode a little bit, you have no idea it's eroding, but it's changing because the materials are getting a bit softer. So for me, it's construction. How good is the actual thing?
A little anecdote about a pedal-based system. Mm-hmm. I've never had one, but I understand that on the earlier ones, you needed to have the washer in between the pedal and the crank arm when you put it all together in order for it to be torqued correctly.
Yeah,
I was coaching a guy. He'd done an FTP test at the university, so using some very accurate information in a lab setting. So they gave him his FTP, and we worked out all his training zones. He put his power pedal, his power pedals on. Unfortunately, because they weren't torqued properly, the measurements he was getting were inaccurate. So it was reading way less than the power he was actually putting in, which meant that he was constantly overestimating how much he needed to put in. He was working so hard. His legs were tired all the time. He went along to a race. He did a 5.5-hour bike split on a flat course in Kalmar. And this is a guy who's quite a tall gentleman. He weighed about 85 kilos. You know, he put in five and a half hour bike split, and had 150 watts as his average power, normalized power for the ride, which it didn't all make sense.
Yeah.
After the race, he was completely exhausted and needed to take 6 months off. And I got him to take his bike back to the shop and check these pedals to see if there was anything wrong or to see if the head unit was measuring wrong. And when they checked, they looked at it and said, oh, yeah, these aren't torqued properly. And that little washer system that you had there, that must have dropped off when you changed the pedals or went traveling. So he'd been pedaling about 30% harder than he needed to in all of his training sessions. And this fatigue had built up over time and completely exhausted him. And I don't think he's done another Ironman distance event since that time. And that's a simple thing, but something that's so easily can happen.
Yeah. I mean, power measurement is not rocket science, but it's also not easy. The instrument is trying to do a tough job. It's trying to take a reading whilst you are essentially jumping up and down on top of it at, you know, in excess of 35 kilometers an hour usually. So, and again, in changing temperature conditions at different altitudes, it's got a relatively tough job. So again, I come back to my point of what do I look for? If it's constructed from softer, cheaper materials, especially plastics, then its job is made even harder, and therefore its ability to help you is made harder. And that's the point that your athlete had there. His power meter at that point, because it was set up wrong, was hindering him completely and putting him completely in a hole that sounds like he's not quite climbed out of.
Okay, well, what about, we didn't mention things like the quark system, the bottom bracket measuring system. That's right at the center of where all that power is going through. So just thinking about those, is there any reason, is that something to do with the material with which the unit's encased?
So yes, ultimately, it's all about the quality of thinking that's gone into the measuring tool and where you've put it and how good the bit of kit is you put it in, how solid is it, basically, how robust. In the spindle, you know, you see a lot of clever instruments go down into the spindle or sit inside of the spider. But looking at the FE analysis, the finite element analysis, and what that is, that's engineering terms for flow of energy. The energy doesn't pass through there as cleanly as it does into other parts of the bike. The reason that Verve put theirs into the crank arm is because they had a completely blank slate. They didn't care where they put it. They didn't already produce a crank arm or a pedals. They had no bias. Where do we get the best reading from? Let's put it there and let's protect it. In the spindle, the power meter is very protected. There's very little damage that's happening to it in there. You're not really jumping up and down it as much. There's a fair bit of lateral torsion, but it's well protected. But the energy doesn't really flow through the spindle. The energy has flowed down the drive chain and away from that area. So it has other problems in that kind of region. And most power meters are located in a suboptimal area, and they build in an algorithm to compensate for it. And it usually comes down to how good that algorithm is. And by that, I mean, how good is the mathematician that they employed to make the algorithm and his understanding of the problem and the data available to him? How good is that algorithm at nullifying all the problems of the design? Think very simply, most of these companies are designing a product with something in mind. They already have a crank set, for instance, or they already make pedals or something like that. Mm. And that's where the danger comes in.
I suppose the other thing which goes to take into consideration, which goes back to our novices question about some of the things to consider, is how maneuverable you want this system. If you've got pedals, you can take them from one bike to another, so you can change it between your winter bike and your summer bike. If you've got it in the rear wheel system, it's pretty much fixed in that type of wheel. So if it's in an aero wheel or a disc wheel, you're not really going to put that on your winter bike, but you can move that from one bike to another. If you've got a bottom bracket, you can take that out. If it's in the chain set in the spider, or if it's in the crank arm, it's less maneuverable, and it does require a little bit more work. But then I guess also that with something like pedals, which are highly removable, and when you're doing that, there's also the risk of the fact that you could cross thread the pedals. And so once you've done that, that makes them unusable. You could damage them in transit, which means that shell that they're being carried in is damaged, and therefore the readings. So I think it's probably also important is to decide not just what your budget is.
Yeah.
What use you want to put it? Are you going to be able to just leave it on one bike, and in which case then you could get something like the ones we mentioned, or do you want to be able to transfer it from one bike to another?
Exactly. So again, that's thinking about your application. You know, are you racing and training a lot and traveling a lot with work? Therefore, taking your power meter with you is very important to you. If so, you know, a pedal system is the obvious choice to look at, especially if you're not taking a whole bike with you, right? If you're renting a bike at location. But the offset that comes with this, and this is the bit that breaks my heart, is that the price most of the time people are paying for pedal-based systems is far too high for the longevity of quality of data they give you. If you've got to pay £700-£800 for a pedal system, and its data is only really good for a few months, you're kind of, as a consumer, you're losing out there. You're losing out there quite hard. If you've only paid a couple of the pounds for it and you don't mind replacing it every season or so, then that's absolutely fine. But the thing that hurts me when I look at people making purchasing decisions and I kind of, oh no, why have you done that? Is you buy it thinking it'll cover you off for the next 3 or 4 years, and actually your value for money is too low because the product company has played on your idea of wanting to be able to move it around. So they put it in a pedal for you to make it seem like it'll do that job well, and you can move it, but you've offset the quality of data. And after a few months, it's making your life that little bit harder when you've paid for it to make it that little bit easier.
Okay. I think you've done a pretty good job there, George, of remaining reasonably impartial.
If we could build everything and make it super consumer focused and easy, that would be the ultimate goal, right? But unfortunately, it's not quite that simple.
Yeah. I've got a few more specific questions now then. So there's a couple here that talk about in terms of the display that you see while you're riding your bike. So the head unit. Mm-hmm. So that could be, you might have one of your systems matched up to a Garmin head unit. So mm-hmm. when you ride, what do you like to see? Personally, when I'm riding, I like to see my normalized power, which is the, if I get the definition right, it's the power that you would get if you didn't freewheel and coast and all of that sort of stuff.
Yep.
I like to see what my absolute power is at that moment. So what am I putting out going up this hill? Not an average. Mm-hmm. Do you know what? I probably don't need anything else in terms of power right then. I pretty much know what my cadence is. I might just like to see the distance I've ridden, so I've got an idea of where the next feed station's coming or something. So those are the two things that are important for me. That the power with each pedal stroke and my normalized power. How about you?
So I'm very similar, to be honest. The power with each pedal stroke is such an important metric. I don't like to see it as a 3-second, a 5-second average, because although that might seem like the number is easier to decipher, it's giving you an average of what you've been doing in that last period of time, not the exact. So when you glance down, you're not actually getting something representative of what's just done. It's not nearly as effective, I don't think, as being able to see straight up power. Aside from the fact that a lot of power meters have problems counting cadence, and that builds in that they average the data anyway, you're kind of getting a very diluted version of what your power is doing. So straight up power, that's my number one. Number two is same as you, it's normalized power. I want to see as an average, once you've removed the freewheeling and the downhill and the power below a certain level, what have I been working as an average for that ride as a power number? I think my most important one that I like is actually my TSS score, so my stress score. So over the course, and I have that pretty much on all my screens now, because, and it's something that I've got used to over time, like we said, you know, understanding myself and my fatigue levels. On a training ride, if I've gone out there knowing this training ride is approximately going to rack up 100 TSS, and you know, I'm looking down and think, oh, that was hard, and I've only got 30 done so far, that gives me a good metric of where I am. It helps me make my decisions better. In a race environment, if I've got a 4-hour road race, I know that's going to cost me 250 TSS. And if, you know, if I'm trying to get in an early break and I've already built up 100 with a long way to go, well, it helps me understand and manage my fatigue going forward. So TSS for me is quite a useful one.
Okay, well let's say we've collected all that data now, so we get to the end of that ride, and as you said earlier, the data is only any good if you actually know what to do with it to help then make your training smarter in the future. So when you're analyzing your power data, what are the three main, there may be more than three, there may only be one, but what are the main things that you're looking for when you're going through that data? And would that differ for a cyclist than for a triathlete?
I suppose a little bit is going to depend on what kind of riding you're doing. But yes, it would definitely differ. I have to train myself to be good in a whole variety of zones, because usually in a bike race, especially in the first hour, there's a lot of work up and above VO2 max. There's a lot of work trying to stick with the group and close brakes, that if you are doing a long distance triathlon, for instance, you've kind of got a more target. You're trying to stay steady. You're trying to stay consistent. So when I'm analyzing my files after a ride, again, I spend a lot of time looking at the normalized power for a specific segment. So if I've gone and done a 3-minute, a 5-minute effort, whatever it happens to look like, I'll look at what was the normalized power for that and how close was that to what my target was. The reason I try and take the normalized there usually is because, again, if I'm in the outside world, I'm always thinking about safety. I've always got my head up, always looking where I'm going. I'm not always looking at that power number. So if it means I have to back off for a moment because there's a junction, an obstacle or whatever, a blind bend, I'm not going to want to pressure myself to stick at that 300 watts through that blind bend. I want to make sure I get around it safe, and then I get back on the power. So the normalized figure helps me kind of keep a rein on that. I quite often will look at my balance for a total ride. And the reason I do that is because I get quite tight in different areas. So my balance number can give me a bit of an overview of, right, that's outside of what's normal for me. And let me just state first and foremost is nobody really rides at 50-50 balance. Most people are within 2 or 3%. But if that happens to have gone the other way, which it can do if you're a bit tight, or if it is a bit closer to 50-50, or if it's a bit further out, especially for when I'm doing an effort, that helps me make a decision, right, I need to sit down this evening and I need to have a bit of a stretch. I need to have a bit more of a relaxed time. You know, have I got anywhere that I haven't noticed in my lower back, in my legs, in my hips, that if I poke them, I've got a trigger point that I could do with working out. So I look at that balance figure and that helps give me a mental check. Know, check my body over, give myself a bit of a poke. After that, it's just really a case of, like I said, matching what was I trying to achieve from the session. And if I'm putting my leg over the bike for a training ride, it's with a goal in mind, right? I've been set a target to achieve, and I want to be able to look and match up how well have I done that. And it's not just on the efforts, it's also on the rest. How well have I rested in between those efforts? Has my heart rate come down? Has my power stayed low? Or, you know, and you see this quite a lot in power files, early in the training session, I might be feeling good. So during my rest, I might've been 40 or 50 watts higher than I should have been because I'm feeling fine. That as a reminder to myself to go, no, because that's not what you're asked to do. I always look at those gaps between the efforts and I say, right, how well did I actually recover in there? Because that's what I've been told to do for this training session. And usually I have to kind of sit my ego down and give it a little telling off every now and again. So look, you clearly worked too hard here. That's not going to help you, because guess what? You've got to train again tomorrow and you don't want to be too tired for that, because it's all about that consistency. So it's really arming myself with the tools to ensure I can build that consistency into my week, into my month, because I know full well there's nothing worse than me messing that up than having to have a period off the bike.
Yeah, the message that no training session should affect your ability to do the one coming after it. So
exactly.
You've got a hard session here, but there's hard and there's too hard, and going too hard doesn't necessarily make you any fitter. But it might mean you can't get to the next session, and that's going to interrupt your consistency.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down from, you know, we're training our bodies here, but your brain's also along for the ride and has quite a big impact as to how what you do to yourself physically. So the metrics I look at afterwards are always a bit more of a check and balance on myself. Did I execute what the plan was? What lessons can I learn, and how do I roll that into the next session or into the next week?
What you mentioned about left and right side, when we had the comp trainer, they had a spin scan thing, which came way before the one that Wattbike used. And we used to find it fantastic when we were watching people, while we had the spin scan view on and the left and right pedal analysis, and you could see somebody that was 45 on the left, 45% on the left, 55 on the right, really imbalanced, and ask them some simple questions like, oh, have you had an injury recently? You know, have you injured that knee? Have you got a problem with it now? Have you had a back injury? 99 times out of 100, you'd be able to pinpoint what was wrong, that somebody was recovering in the process of, you know, getting over something, or they'd got a bad back and it was just limiting the power output. And also what we saw was that as people got tired, they'd start off with an imbalance, or they'd start off fairly balanced, so that within a couple of percent either side, and then as they got tired, the dominant leg took over and the weaker leg shut down.
Yeah.
Or what you found was that when they were doing, they could keep the balance while they were riding steady, but when they came to putting the power out, an imbalance came in as well. And actually fixing that, going back to the physio, fixing the biomechanical issue was often more effective than trying to help them put out more absolute power.
Yeah. So coming back to your question of what do I look at, when I start and sit and look at a training file, I start from the end and work my way back towards the start, knowing full well at the end of it, I'm unlikely to have hit exactly the power number for whatever duration I was trying to achieve. But at what point did that kind of those two diverge between my ability to hold whatever I was trying to do and what I was aiming to do? And that especially comes down to balance, because again, that shows where my weaknesses are that I need to be mindful of. yeah, so it's giving yourself all those tools to kind of see. It's more than just that pedal stroke in the training session, isn't it? It's thinking about everything else that goes and constitutes towards being a useful, effective athlete when it comes to a race day.
And that, but for me as a triathlon coach as well, and looking at the performance of triathletes was very telling, because if, as somebody was coming to the end of particularly a long, you know, race where a 70.3 or an Ironman, where they're out there for, 56, 112 miles, if that left leg is getting weaker towards the end of that ride, that's going to have a huge influence on how they run.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, yes.
You know, no matter how fit they are when they're fresh, if they're left leg. I mean, look at Lionel Sanders. I don't know what Lionel Sanders' problem is with his right leg, but there's no doubt that as he gets tired towards the end of the run, or depending on how much power effort he's putting onto the bike earlier on in the run, he is definitely carrying that leg like a wounded soldier limping along towards the finish. And it looks so painful. And I every time I see him, I'm thinking, if I could help you fix that leg, Lionel, we could do a lot with your performance. Never mind trying to be more powerful. Never mind trying to be a vegan. Fix that flipping hip. and somebody once said to me, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm like, look at the flipping video. There's something wrong with the leg.
And it's interesting, isn't it? When we talk about cycling tech, whether it be power meters, whatever it happens to be, you can get really, really in depth with these kind of things. You know, the one that we work with, the InfoCrank, if you want to really push on your performance, the tech opens up so many doors to look at. You know, we've come a long way from where SpinScan was back in the day with CompuTrainer, so much so that there's just now so much more beneath that we can look at. What I like about the InfoCrank, for people that really want to push on and, you know, want to spend the time and the money on it, you can look at your pedal stroke in so many more data points than you could do with the early spin scans and on the Watt bike, so much so that we can really help dial in people's positions a bit more. We can work out the effectiveness of oval chain rings based on how you pedal. We can look at how to increase your pedal efficiency with such a measure that a lot of brands try and do, but in what the InfoCrank gets right in the instrument, it just does so well. A key one that is coming and becoming more popular, as in more coaches talk about, is actually measuring pure torque. So that's moving away from the watt figure, which is the torque times the cadence times the lever, and it's looking at that pure torque, because what that gives you is a good understanding of what the athlete can do at different cadence values, because watts changes with your cadence. So if you can look at and think, like, this athlete actually is better at a grinding cadence than he is at a higher tempo, you can learn a lot about how they generate power, and you can really fine tune athletes' performance and kind of work on what works for them if you've got that torque number, which is what you can do with a really good system.
Yeah. But I just one thing did come to mind, George, that we didn't talk about when we were discussing the various types. You sort of touched on the stages, which is a left-sided crank that measures from one side. So how do one-sided power meters give you the accuracy of something like the pedals or like your system that's measuring off both sides?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. And a lot of the other products that came to market in the last 7 or 8 years started off as a single-sided crank. I think you can get a stages nowadays that is double. But essentially what any single system is doing is it's just doubling the reading it takes from the side it's measuring, because that's all it can do, really. If you've only got one side of the equation, you can only assume the other side is almost exactly the same. So you assume it's exactly the same. So the problem with that is that it doesn't tell you the whole picture of how an athlete interacts with the bike. And this, the point I kept making is, get the best instrument you can. Which of all the tools available gives you the best overview and the best data of how the athlete and bike are working together? If you're only measuring from one small part of that, well, you're going to be hindered, and your ability to be effective from a coach and coached athlete point of view is shackled slightly. So it, very simply, they just read just the one side. In fact, you know, our system, it reads from both crank arms, but if the batteries die in one middle of a training ride, you've not had time to change them over, it will then just start to double the other one to kind of try and keep up the consistent level of data. Of course, you put your batteries out, you're good to go again, but that's a kind of fallback system, if you like.
Does that mean then that if you've got a stages and it's measuring one side and one leg is weaker, it's not going to show you an imbalance in that pedaling, because it can't assume that the other leg will be equally strong or weak? if it doesn't know. So any data that he gives you on left versus right is not that accurate.
Exactly that. I think if any instrument is purporting to give you balanced data, it needs to be able to read balance fairly across the whole piece of equipment you're working with. If it's not doing that, then it is selling you a bit short. And again, as we said earlier on with the example of your athlete who had the pedals torqued wrong, that becomes dangerous. That leads people down the holes of overtraining. Undertraining isn't so bad, because undertraining you more just disappoint yourself, but overtraining, that can put you in a hole that takes months to come back from sometimes. And again, that's where I personally, I'm not too much a big fan of a lot of marketing that exists in cycling. I think it's very, very simple and very unchecked in sport as a whole. And you've seen that from the early days of sports science with Gatorade all the way through to now what we're looking at with videos and power meters and stuff. If you're not putting the athlete first and foremost, and the athlete's health first and foremost, it's not really the one for me, because I want to be able to gear it. Anytime you're detracting from an athlete's ability to understand themselves and make good conscious decisions, you're hurting the athlete. So if you're telling them the wrong power considerably, your chance of them pushing themselves too hard and having an injury or overtraining is just not worth the risk. I'd rather the athlete didn't have anything and went off a feel.
That seems like a good place to sum up what we've talked about, George, I think. Mm-hmm. Putting the athlete first, thinking mm-hmm. about health. So before you even consider buying a power meter, what other things could you do that help you to be a better performing human being? So if that's more sleep, better rest, listening to your body, those are definitely preferable to getting your hand in your pocket and pulling out your credit card. If you are at that point now where you've covered all of those bases, and feel free to jump in and tell me if I'm off track here, George, but mm-hmm. my understanding of our conversation is, first ask yourself why you want to get that. Why you want to get a power meter, and then what you're going to do with the data once you've got it. It's no good just showing people figures on a screen, because that doesn't do anything to improve your fitness. Obviously, you need to think about your budget. So what's the mm-hmm. best device for measuring what you want to get for your budget? Clearly, portability has got to be a consideration, how much you mm-hmm. want to move it around. But be aware that that compromise of portability means that the data might not be as accurate, or the product might not last as long, as you're constantly putting it in and out and
Exactly. Spinning
threads, and there's always a chance when you're in a rush that you can cross-thread stuff. If you've got one, and you then take a moment to understand what the data is, be realistic with the power you're using. It's not an ego thing about having the biggest FTP and working to it if you're constantly overtraining. It's about having something that's usable and realistic. And use that training to make you smarter. And by smarter, I come back to what you just said, that you use it to help you understand your body, so that on race day, you don't necessarily need to keep looking down at that power meter. Or if in the event that that battery fails, or the power meter's working, but your head unit suddenly goes because it's got water in it and you've gone blank, can you operate without the gadgets? Because if you go into meltdown when the head unit stops working and you start flapping, all of that training that you've done has gone to waste. And I'm pretty certain that all those guys that we talked about in the Pro Tour that use power meters all the time, if you mm-hmm. took away Bernal's power meter or Froome or any of the others, they could operate perfectly well without it and finish that race, and probably wouldn't affect where they finish in the bunch.
It'd be such a small change that it wouldn't matter whatsoever. They are just in tune with themselves. And that's the one danger of sports tech, is if it's hindering you understanding yourself, well, then it's not helping at all. The best change I've made to my training as an amateur athlete in the last 3 years is that me and my training partner, we now get an extra hour sleep every single day. It's a system we implemented about 8 months ago. And since doing that, I am stronger, I'm more consistent, I've been injury-free just because of that. Sure, I train to power every day and I use all those things, but I've been doing that for a long, long time. Until I start getting an extra hour of sleep, that's where I've seen the real differences, the real change. So the tech is there to have benefits from, but just be sensible with it. And if you're going to go down the tech, look at where's that tech come from. If that company's main thing is building bicycles, we'll probably let them specialize in bicycles. If you want to get an instrument, go and talk to a brand that specializes in instruments. That's what I'd say.
Yeah, and ultimately, the power meter is measuring what you're doing. It's not doing it for you, is it? And what's helping you put that output is the sleep, the recovery, the nutrition, and smart thinking.
Yeah, I tell you what, Simon, when it comes to this weekend's race, and I can see the first rider disappearing up the road, and I'm asking myself, do I want to be in this break? Does he look like a strong guy? My power meter is not going to help me catch him no matter what. So that all comes down to managing my own effort, understanding, have I got it in the tank? Can I get him? If I get to him, can I stay with him?
George, it's been fantastic having you on the show. Thank you so much. You've done it. I think you've done a fantastic job of remaining fairly impartial there. It could too easily have turned into an infomercial for Info Cycling. However,
I tried.
However, what we will do is for those people who are interested in finding out a little bit more about your product, we will put some links on the show notes. I will also share the DC Rainmaker power meter review, because he goes into all the products, the technical aspects as well, and so people can have a look at that. So that's good. Where else can people follow you, George? Are you on Facebook? Do you have a website?
So we're on Jam Cycling. We're on the internet, jam-cycling.com. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook. We've got a couple of little vlogs that we do. We're quite socially active. And the one thing that we try and do is we're very consumer-centric. If you've got questions, please just come and ask. Because I don't mind if you end up going buying something else. Because when the time's right for you, the products we offer will make sense. So if you've got questions, just come and have a chat and we'll try and figure out what works for you and what you need.
Perfect, George. And going back to those questions I was asking you, they were sent in by our Facebook followers and podcast listeners. So if I answered and George answered your question today, thanks very much for posting that. I hope we've given you all of the information that you were asking for. But if not, then George has given you an invitation there to continue that discussion with him. I'll put all of these contact links and different bits of information onto the show notes. But from me, George, thank you very much for joining us. Been a pleasure. I'll catch up with you again soon. Listeners, thanks very much for being with us again. We always try to bring you the best guests that are going to help you get more out of your triathlon and cycling. But for now, enjoy the rest of your week.
That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWAT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose. And for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swimrun events. As a SWAT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover, and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWAT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page, and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWAT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.